Nice to meet you.
Yeah, I'm delighted.
Okay, good. You better have some great shit to talk about.
I had to refresh my memory a little bit this morning. I was like, let's see. Now, before March 2020, I used to be a musician. Let me see if I remember what that was like.
Yeah. Well, I got some good reminders and questions, I hope. And,
excellent. No, I'm totally psyched. I think we're gonna have a blast.
Yeah, yeah. And are you at home or are you?
I am. I'm at home. I'm upstairs in my sort of little makeshift office. My parents are visiting.
Oh, okay.
Because we hadn't seen them in almost 2 years. So they're doing their thing down all the way up here.
Okay. All right. Wow. You kids want to get started?
Or? Sure. I'm ready. Let's do it.
All right, man. Yeah. We got to have a little theme song.
Okay.
Jumping right in.
Yeah. Might as well.
So happy right now.
Yeah, I know. Here we are. This is a good one for me. We have a good show today. I hope so, anyway. Uh-huh. I could always fall flat on my face. But, I'm John Rawhaus.
I'm Blaine Long.
And we have Darren Baum running the gear back here. And this is the Musician's Guide to Everything podcast. And we have a great guest today. It is the inimitable Josh Canner, who is mostly known for being the organist for the Boston Red Sox, but also indie rock musician, touring musician, and you also what's the college you work for?
I work for a small college in the Boston area. You may have heard of it's called Harvard University. Where I work as a music librarian.
Yes, exactly. So if we want to find that fifth Mahler piece, we call you.
Exactly. You want to see the different iterations of it? I can show you that.
Sure. Let's see that. The people on the podcast aren't going to see it, but we're going to look at it. It's
like, what's that? What are we looking at?
The different iterations of what he does here. Let's see.
Where are you going?
Yeah, we're going on a trip. We're going down the hall.
Oh, sorry. No. I'm just moving to a
secure location.
I'm moving to a more Wi-Fi friendly spot.
I like this.
Oh, okay.
But yeah.
Nice.
But inimitable. I like that. I appreciate that.
There you go. Well, I knew because you worked at that small college, you might understand that word.
I was just going to ask, what does this mean? Right?
Inimitable is like one of a kind. Somebody who's
unable to be imitated.
There you go. Thank you. See? Because he looked it up.
He's a rocket scientist.
Yeah, he's a rocket scientist. He Googled it.
I just heard somebody was using this word the other day.
Mm-hmm. I forgot to say it.
I think it was our
friend Darren here, who actually is a musician and a recording engineer, also is a rocket scientist. all right.
He reminds
Josh.
Us often. Yeah.
Back to Josh. How's it feel to be back and playing at the ballpark?
It feels pretty good. I did play last year during we had a 2 month season that started very late.
Yeah.
And that was for an empty building, which was pretty depressing.
Yeah.
But I guess they wanted me there to kind of just to have the broadcast pick up the sound a little bit, just to give it some of that flavor. Cause I think the whole idea was like, if we play baseball, then it'll just bring people some sense of comfort and familiarity if they're big baseball fans. And so I think that was the idea, was just to hear it a little bit on TV and radio.
Yeah.
But being in there every day and being distanced and all this stuff, it was like, it wasn't exactly fun. I mean, I was glad I got to watch baseball and play some tunes, but so much of it for me is about the interplay with the crowd and feeding off of that. And that was just totally absent. So, and the team didn't play very well either. So that was, there wasn't much motivation on that side. But then we started back this spring on a quote unquote normal schedule. Although we were capped at 5,000 people for the month of April. And then in May that went up to 10,000. And then in June it went up to full, which for us is 38,000. Although I don't think we've had more than 25 or 26,000 in thus far. I think a lot of people aren't quite ready to come back yet, or aren't ready to come travel to be there. And that's just going to take some time. And so I'm not complaining like, oh, geez, I'm only playing for 26,000 people.
Yeah.
But it's just sort of like,
tough.
But it's a, but it's just been a very, very gradual kind of rebuild, but it has been fun this year as far as, well, A, the team is playing well this year, which definitely lifts people's spirits. And the people who are coming are so grateful and happy and thankful to be there. You know how we all were a year ago where I can go to a concert again, or I can go to a cookout again. It's going to feel even sweeter than before. And I think people are in that phase right now of feeling that sweetness. So that's been great in terms of just like having fantastic vibes at the games. They've had a lot of student discount tickets to try to, you know, fill some of these empty seats. So there's a very youthful vibe at the game.
That's good.
Which I love. And I do this, John knows about this. I do this ridiculous thing where I take song requests via Twitter from people in the stands. And
it's awesome.
Just tweet me. They'll tweet me and be like, I want to hear this song. And if I know it, I'll play it. And if I don't know it, I'll pull up a stream of it on my laptop and listen in the earbud. And usually if I listen once or twice, I can at least get the basics. I can get the melody and get the changes. I can get the hook. And I can play, you know, 30 seconds of it at some juncture in the game. And it's mostly kind of pop and rock songs. So nothing terribly complicated.
Yeah.
So they have this sort of disposableness to them for me where like I can hear it, learn it, play it, forget it, and then move on to the next one.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's been, that part has been great because that was always like such a part of the magic for me and for the people who enjoy that aspect of coming to the game. You know, it's obviously totally secondary to like the fact that there's a baseball game being played on the field. And it's probably secondary even to things like what people are eating and drinking, but it's just, you know, it's part of the flavor. And I think it's, and people, a lot of people remember, and they'll come back to me years later and say, like, I requested this song from you and it was, you played it and it was great. And I don't remember it, but because I do thousands of them, but they remember it. And it means a lot to me that, you know, that it meant something to them and that they remembered it. And, but because it's such a young crowd this year, I'm learning a lot of new, you know, like current top 40, which is not really on my radar generally.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm up to speed right now on all the latest, you know.
There you go.
Taylor Swift and Olivia Rodrigo and Drake and all that. So.
Oh, there you go. Awesome. Well, I gotta assume that's what happened. That's how I ended up meeting you because you played Nico's man at the ballpark. Was that a Twitter request from someone?
I think it was. And I think it was a new or new-ish song at the time.
Yeah, yeah. It was right when it came out. Yeah.
Yeah. So someone at the ballpark who obviously was a Nico fan, and I've been a Nico fan myself for a long time. And I think I do get like, you know, probably 90 to 95% of what I play is like popular hits, whether it was a popular hit last year or 20 years ago or 50 years ago or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It's songs that people are going to recognize and maybe even across generations. But I think partly because I have a, you know, to whatever minimal extent I have a reputation in terms of being known for playing with a lot of indie artists, being a fan of a lot of indie artists, knowing a lot of indie artists, it's like, I get those requests. So that small subsection of people who like go to Fenway and who are into these indie bands, they know that if they, you know, that if they tag me that like there's a chance that I'll do it for them and I'll play it. And it's like, you know, where else can you go to hear the new Nico Case single performed as a ballpark organ instrumental?
Yeah, that's insane.
It's awesome, actually.
So somebody
sent it to me while it was happening. They were at the ballpark.
Yeah, so that's what happened was I played it. And I mentioned that to Hogan because Hogan and I were friendly. We knew each other a little bit at the time and have since become quite close.
So
I mentioned to her like, hey, just FYI, I played it. And you guys were in the van in New England, I think, or on the bus or whatever in New England at the time.
Yeah, I think so.
So she said, you know, do you have a recording? A, do you have a recording? And B, do you want to come to the show in New Hampshire tomorrow night or something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't manage to get a recording out of it, but I came home after the game and I have an organ in my home that is very, very similar to the one at Fenway.
Yeah.
That's kind of the practice instrument. And so I whipped up a quick little version on there, sent it to Hogan, and then she shared it with the whole band.
Yeah.
And then when I showed up in New Hampshire, the next night, you know, she was like, come backstage. Everybody wants to meet you.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
And so that's how you and I connected.
Yeah. And you had enough sense to bring that World Series ring.
Right. I knew that was a, you know, yeah. It's a conversation piece.
Yeah,
for sure.
No kidding.
It's a pretty good icebreaker.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Wait, you also get a ring?
Yeah.
Well, is that how it works? So,
It depends. So I've been extremely fortunate that the Red Sox have won the World Series four times since I started there in 2003.
Yeah.
The first two times I didn't get a ring. I guess I just sort of didn't make the cut in terms of the people who were deemed worthy or had sufficiently contributed, or who knows what the criteria is. I really don't know. And then the third and fourth time I did make the cut and I got rings on those two occasions, which was, you know, it's a lovely gesture and a lovely memento, and it's nice to be recognized. But I honestly, from one to the next, I have no insight or notion as to like what the criteria are or who decides like how people make the cut or how they don't. So I try not to think about it too much, but it's certainly, you know, they're really lovely, memorable little keepsakes of special seasons.
So cool.
Yeah. Man. No kidding, man.
Wow.
They're really nice. They're huge.
They're gaudy.
Yeah. That's, I don't think,
I think sports jewelry by design is gaudy.
I was going to say the only piano player I think could pull it off is Liberace.
Right. And do you know do you know his quote about that when he was asked about that? They, you know, somebody famously asked him like, how do you play with all those giant rings on your fingers? And he said, quite well, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and he does. Yeah. Or did. That's like, awesome, man. And so you do play with a lot of indie rock bands too. I mean, like, and you are definitely like the fifth Beatle in the Baseball Project.
It's something that I, you know, I've always enjoyed a lot of that music. And I've known Steve Wynn from the Dream Syndicate and Linda Pittman,
who's for a monster, time. By the way, Jesus.
Yeah, she's great, really, drummer. She's one of those people, like, I have learned so much from her just about like how to be in a band and how to carry yourself and how to be the kind of side player that other people want to play with.
Yeah.
And she's such a just, you know, hilarious, friendly, wonderful, smart person to boot. But I've known them. I probably met them around 01 because a fellow I went to college with, Jason Victor, an amazing guitar player. He played with Matthew Sweet and Alejandro Escovedo, and he's in the reunion lineup for Dream Syndicate, a bunch of other things. But he and I were in a band together in college, and we had stayed in touch. And then so he told me, he's like, hey, I'm playing with Steve Wynn now. I was like, it's amazing. So, you know, I would go to see them in Boston or New York and would just kind of end up at the end of the night talking to Steve and Linda about music and about baseball. And then, you know, fast forward a few years and they start this baseball band, this band that plays, you know, writes songs original rock baseball. Songs about baseball. And so they were, at some point along the way, they were like, well, we put a bunch of keyboards on this record, but we don't have a touring keyboard player, but we'd love to have you, you know, do some of the shows with us whenever the schedule works out. And I was like, yeah, it'd be amazing. It'd be wonderful. And that was about 10 years ago. And prior to that, I had really never played outside of Boston.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, like I had this high profile gig at Fenway, but as far as playing clubs and theaters and stuff, I was just playing around. I was just playing around town.
Yeah.
Maybe once I'd gone to play New York or something, but all of a sudden it was like, okay, you're getting in a van with Steve and Linda. And also with, you know, Scott McCoy, who is sort of the epicenter of a lot of indie rock stuff.
Oh yeah.
And then typically Peter Buck and or Mike Mills from REM was in the lineup.
Yeah.
And you know, you hang out with those guys and it's like you get your graduate degree in how to, how to be in a band and how to travel in a band and how to play and all the, I barely knew how to do a proper sound check when I first started playing with these guys who've been selling out arenas for decades. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At what age did you do this? What age?
He's doing it right now. He's still doing it.
But when did you start jumping into this scene?
I started with that 10 years ago. So I was 38 at the time, which is like kind of late to start touring, I think, especially when you're in a band with people in their 50s who started doing it when they were 18.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everybody was super friendly and super happy to, you know, share their their knowledge and their insights with me and just be kind, fun, enjoyable bandmates. And plus the fact that like we all, you know, shared this love of baseball that provided endless fun conversation, you know, and that naturally they had curiosity about my game, because even though they've, you know, jammed with Bono and jumped on stage with Neil Young, you know, like they've never played at the World Series before. Yeah, so they're like, what's that like?
Yeah, exactly. Well, also between McCoy and Wynn, there's like a baseball encyclopedia going on there.
Exactly.
It is funny out in the world that I know a lot of, maybe it's because I know that I get to go when I'm out on tour. One of the first things I do is look to see what cities we're in, whether there's a ball club, even if it's minor league. And if we're off and I can go make the show and, you know, that's, and I think there are a lot of, musicians out there that do that.
Yeah. It's been really interesting to learn to meet people who do that, because like once I became, you know, friendly with those folks and played with them, you immediately start to meet lots of other people. And Peter Buck, for reasons unknown to me, other than he's just a total sweetheart, was like telling people like, hey, have you heard this guy Josh? He's pretty good. And then the phone starts ringing, you know, for gigs as a result. So, you know, just that was kind of the moment, you know, 9-10 years ago when my universe just sort of expanded in terms of people I knew and people I was being asked to play with, people who play all over the world. And so that's when I started meeting all these people who would tell me like, oh yeah, I always check out a gate, you know, if it's a Sunday day game and it's across the street from the venue, you know, like you guys have played that House of Blues on Lansdowne Street. That's literally a stone's throw from Fenway Park.
Yeah.
And I think there even was a game that you guys came to like the first 7 innings and then you had to go across the street for sound check or something.
Yeah, I think
so.
Yeah.
And then I caught up with you guys after the game, after the show. And, so those kinds of things. And Scott is definitely one of those people who will like route tours around which teams are playing on the days off and which teams have day games.
Yeah.
But it's been amazing to see how many other people really love doing that. So I always encourage, I mean, not that I have any clout or sway in terms of how people decide to route these things, but I'm always like, you know, if you can build in a day off in Boston, which is tough because it's expensive, but I'll say, you know, like if you somehow, you know, or if you have a Sunday night show and you want to come to the day game, you know, it'd be great to see you and I'll play one of your songs and I'll show you around. And it's a delightful thing. And for some bands who travel on a smaller scale, you know, who are maybe in the Econoline, like we've built guest space at our home for them to crash. And so it's been a really nice way to connect with a lot of traveling bands who, you know, and then many of whom have reciprocated and put me up when I'm in San Francisco or Seattle or wherever I am.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's a great way to, you have friends everywhere. You end up having friends everywhere.
Yeah.
And
that part is,
no, go ahead.
Oh no. That part is wonderful. Like there are so many cities now where I can go there for whatever reason, whether it's a gig or just to explore the city or maybe it's even like a, you know, a library related work thing for me. And, and I know friendly people there.
Yeah. It's awesome.
And there is something to, I mean, you guys will understand this and, you know, maybe you've even spoken about it before. Like there is, when you play with someone and it's a special and it goes really well, like there is a bond that happens beyond, like it's a very fast get to know you kind of thing.
Right.
As opposed to, you know, like sometimes, I mean, the hang might be excellent and you're chatting and you're getting to know each other and that's all great and wonderful. But I have found that like when I play with someone when I play with someone for the first time and I love it and it goes great and they love it, like that automatically means that like, you know, my spare room is your spare room.
Yeah.
You know, for the rest of eternity.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Got a lot of bands sleeping in my tiny little house in Phoenix, man.
Yeah.
Oh man, that's awesome. And then, so like, who'd you go with? Did you go with the Waco brothers to Norway or something? Or who was that? Didn't you go?
Oh my goodness. That was, you're very close actually. Yeah. That you've sort of conflated a couple of different insane stories, but
I'll do that during this whole thing. I'll do that.
Yeah, no, it's great. So I met, I'll try to give let's see, how should we do this? I met John Langford on a flight where we were both going. I was connecting through Chicago. No, I don't remember. Whatever. We were on a flight together to a festival. We were on a flight together to a festival that Peter Buck was hosting in Mexico. And I had a longtime fan of his. I introduced myself. And I had my little travel size accordion with me on the plane because it fits under the seat. And he's, you know, and he looks at me and he says in that Welsh accent, he's like, is that an accordion then? Yeah. You know, and I'm like, yes, it is. He goes, you won't be in my band.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And that was 8 years ago. And ever since then, whenever we're in the same town at the same time,
yeah,
we get on stage together in some configuration or another. And so through that, wow. I think mostly through him, but just, I mean, you know, I ended up meeting all of those Chicago people that you know so well, John, and that you've worked with. And it's such an incredible scene, and I feel very comfortable there. And I've been so lucky to get to work with a lot of those people. But so I've played a lot with the Waco Brothers, just jump up with an accordion and add, you know, a little pet. You know, they don't need much. They're like
it's balls out.
It's that band is, they are. The way I described it to someone, when I'm like, it's like five Tasmanian devils all at the same time.
It is. It is.
So,
it totally is.
So they don't, the last thing they need is another, somebody devils. Jumping around. So yeah. I keep my feet on the ground and I play with these legato chords underneath all of the thrashing. And it's awesome. I love it.
Oh, yeah.
I've
toured with them before too. It was like,
they're maniacs off the stage as so, which is great. It's always a blast. But I did, I went to Norway in 2015 where, this woman who is British and who I met again through kind of that whole extended scene, she decided to put on a rock festival in a small town. She's an artist and she was working as an artist in residence in this town in far northeastern Norway up in the Arctic Circle.
Nice.
But it was a tiny little town, you know, on this lovely fjord. Yeah. And it was, she just knew, you know, a lot of music and art people from her life. And so she just kind of invited a bunch of people and said, anybody who wants to come, we'll put on some shows up here at the little community center, you know, this building that holds maybe 300 people. And it'll be a blast. And we'll just have fun hanging out together and exploring this culture together. She's like, I really love it here. I came up here and I love everything about the place. And I want to share it with you. So a bunch of us went up there and it was those baseball project folks that I mentioned. And then a bunch of English musicians that, that she was friends with, and that she had known, and, including, John Paul Jones, who was in what was that band he was in? Led Zeppelin.
Exactly.
doesn't ring a bell.
Yeah.
So he, they're kind of a bluesy outfit.
I'll look them up.
They were ambitious.
Love the phrase outfit.
No. Exactly. Yeah. Little combo.
Yeah. Exactly.
Obviously, you know, just one of my all-time favorite bands. Yeah. He's one of my all-time favorite musicians because he does the thing that I love to do, which is to be the person not in the spotlight. But the person who adds so much dimension underneath. And John, you well know all about that. You're a master of that.
Thank you,
and
sir.
So,
and Mike Mills, to bring his name
time
up.
With him.
Yeah.
And to just, like, it was, again, I was like, I just want to absorb and savor every moment of this. And the amazing thing was, and I've since hung out with him a few other times and played some other shows with him. And he really is, you know, he's a musician. He would rather be playing than doing anything else, even in his 70s, after everything that he's been through and all the incredible successes and all the fame and fortune. You know, like we got together, there were maybe 15 of us, and we're kind of trying to work up a couple of sets that we could do. And we were sort of mixing and matching like the American personnel and the British personnel. And, and it was just different songs from everybody's back catalogs because there were a few great writers there who had wonderful, you know, songs that we could draw from, and then whatever sort of some you know, favorite covers that we had that we wanted to work on. And we'd do these rehearsals, and then ultimately we did the shows. But even after the rehearsal, you know, like we'd rehearse from, I don't know, noon to six or something, and then it's time for dinner, you know, and then John would say to me, like, meet me in the hotel lobby after dinner and bring your accordion. And I was like, well, I'm not going to say no to that.
Yeah.
And he would show up with his mandolin.
Yeah.
And we just sat in the hotel lobby playing all night long. And other folks, the singers and songwriters and guitar players, would come in for a while and sit. And, you know, we were doing song swaps, and John and I were just sort of backing everybody up on mandolin and accordion. But he didn't want to leave. He was perfectly happy to go all night. And I was like, if he's not leaving, I'm not leaving.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that was sort of the most memorable part. But yeah, there was one rehearsal, one of the rehearsals where you could tell kind of like everybody, including like the other rock stars who were there, wanted to ask him, like, hey, how do you feel about doing a Zeppelin song at the show? But everyone was afraid to ask. And perhaps he could sense that, because at some point near the end of the rehearsal, he said to everybody, he's like, hey, do you guys know that song? When the Levee Breaks. And we're all sort of like, yeah, I think I remember how that one goes. Let's try. And he's like, well, let's work it up. And
awesome.
And so we ran through it a couple of times, and it's actually, you know, the thing I learned, and the thing we all learned, because I think we all felt like, oh, I've heard the song 1,000 times. Surely I can play it.
Yeah.
That song is, there's no crazy chords in it, but like, it has so many just slightly quirky twists and turns and things you have to remember, and long sections where you all have to like come back in. You have to know right where to come back in.
Yeah.
You know, it's 'cause it's not like a vamp. It's a structured, it sounds vampy, but it's not.
Yeah.
And so we ran through it, and the thing is we never nailed it in rehearsal. And so I was thinking like, oh, we're probably not going to do it at the show. And I think other people were thinking that. And John said, he's like, well, it wasn't perfect, but, you know, we'll do it at the show tomorrow, and I'm sure it'll be great.
Yeah.
So then we're all kind of nervous. Like, we've all been, you know, put on notice a little bit. I think the rest of us all went back to our hotel rooms and were listening to the recording and, like, practicing our own parts individually to make sure that we had it. And then we came in and we played it in a community center in the Arctic Circle.
Dude, you got to,
like, I think it was, oh my God, I think it was,
yeah.
I think it was literally the first, show I had ever played in Europe was playing When the Levee Breaks with John Paul Jones in the Arctic Circle.
Exactly. You win. And you win.
Yeah, in a 300-seat community center. And we nailed it, and it felt amazing.
That's awesome, man.
It's a good drug.
So,
yeah.
Totally awesome. That was the first Norway adventure.
Yeah. That's awesome. Okay, so I do have to get to, you know, I mean, like, just thinking about, if you got any questions, go away. I got a million. So it's the whole, we do this podcast because we want to like let people know there's 80 million, maybe not 80 million, but a lot of music lives, you know, like how you can be a musician out there in the world. Mm-hmm. How did you get the gig at Fenway?
Yeah, there are 79 and a half million ways.
Yes.
Not quite 80 million.
Yes, but, exactly. Thanks for correcting me.
No, well, it's funny because this is something that amazes me to no end in the baseball organ, in the sports organist scene, which there's a little bit of a community, you know, like we're in touch with each other.
Sure.
It's like a little informal association, because we can talk shop with the only other people who understand what the hell it is. Yeah.
I mean, there's like I guess there's some minor league guys too, but
yeah, there's, you know, there's about 20 in the majors, and then there's a handful in the minors, and then there's another 20 to 30 in hockey.
We have
a little email group where we share, you know, knowledge and information, and we share the ups and downs and the frustrations and the triumphs. And it's a wonderful community. Everybody's super cool. And I think because everybody wants to, you know, help each other learn, and the old people help the new people. And I used to be the new people, and now I'm the old people. So I'm on that side of helping the new people. And
cool.
It's beautiful, but I've seen the same thing, you know, in indie rock as well, which is that there's just not like, there's no shortage of pathways to get to this stuff. And in the baseball world, everybody, all the organ players have a different background. Some of them, like, just have a few little licks, and that's their bread and butter. And then some are trained jazz organists, and some are trained classical organists, and some are trained church organists, and some are like me that are, you know, just was, I was always obsessed with popular songs as a kid growing up. And I took classical lessons in grade school. But after that, by the time I was a teenager, all I wanted to do was like listen to the radio or listen to my parents' records, and then eventually listen to my own records and play along and try to figure out, like, wow, try to unlock all that math of like how do chord progressions work and how do intervals work. And then I did, in college and a little bit after college, I was playing in bands and I was playing in, doing like in like orchestra pits for musical theater productions. But the main thing that helped me with the baseball was I was working as a keyboard accompanist for an improvisational theater group.
Oh, okay.
And the similarities are really striking, because you have players on a stage and you don't know what's going to happen next. But you want to be thinking on your feet and you want to quickly have a musical idea that underscores the action or drives the action forward or follows the action or supports the action in some way. And it was kind of like being a sideman for actors. I learned so much from that about how to play off of others and how to really be paying attention and how to have your gears turning at all times. And that has served me extremely well with the Red Sox thing. But how did I actually get it? They had a vacancy at the beginning of 2003. I knew someone at the time, he was working for the team, and it happened to be someone I had written songs with and had performed with a bit. He's like, this guy, Josh, he knows how to play and he knows how to improvise and he knows baseball. He knows the ins and outs of baseball, which is a genuine, like, it's a, what do they call it? A bona fide occupational qualification. Mm-hmm. Like you can be the best organ player in the world, but if you don't know how to anticipate that there might be a double play or a pinch hitter or a sacrifice fly, then you're it's not the great gig for you. So this fella recommended me to the folks who were overseeing the auditions. So that was my foot in the door to get an audition. I had an audition. I thought it went okay, but not great. And then I didn't hear anything. So I assumed they had moved on. So I thought I would move on. And several weeks later, they called me out of the blue, like not long before the season started. And they said, can you come in for a callback? And how soon can you come in for a callback? And I knew from past audition experience, and I don't know, John, if you've had auditions like this where there's callbacks and stuff.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I in my experience, usually if they say callback and how soon, like that means you're in the top two probably.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so that just gave me a ton of confidence. And I went in and I remember thinking that audition was really excellent. And they quizzed me on a bunch of different, genres of popular songs and could I play this and that. And they quizzed me on little, short hits that I could do and quizzed me on situations in games. Like if this kind of thing is happening in the game, what do you think is a song that would go for, that would fit with it? Or what's a cheeky, comment that you can make with the melody, with a lyric of the song to match the thing that's happening on the field. And it went really well. And right there at the end of that audition, they said, you're the one we want. So
that's awesome.
So that's how it went. Wow. And, so it's like, you have to be, I think as with any sort of dream gig or plum gig, you have to be reasonably well qualified to start. And then you have to have some luck in terms of the right place at the right time, because I don't presume by any stretch to be the best organist in town. And I'm way better at it now than I was when I started 18 years ago, just because I've had the opportunity to do it.
Yeah.
81 nights a year for 18 years.
That's pretty good.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, like, it brings to mind, you know, Dave Max Crawford, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And he,
love that guy.
I do too. He's a, horn player and organ player, keyboard player for, Poi Dog Pondering. Yep. And he also has a horn section in Chicago called the Total Pro Horns. And
he writes horn arrangements for a lot of indie rock bands.
Yeah, he's one of the dudes. He's great. He looks like an old Southern colonel.
Really?
He's got the mustache that twists up like that,
Well, he's a Louisiana native, I believe.
So. Yeah, because Poi Dog came from New Orleans. Yeah. But right. he he wants that gig at Wrigley.
Sure.
Really well, badly.
Yes. Well, it's funny. He's been working in the AV department at Wrigley Field for a number of years. He works the scoreboards and such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he was one of these people that for years people were like, you got to meet this guy because he's like, you guys just have so much in common between the rock and the baseball and whatever.
Yeah.
And we finally connected maybe 6 years ago and, you know, we've been tight buds ever since. But so we have no shortage of stuff to talk about between our baseball work and our music work. But he, you know, he's a skilled keyboard player, and the Cubs did have a vacancy at the beginning of last season. And it was this fella, Gary Pressey, had been in that seat for 33 years, I think, something like that.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So, you know, those jobs don't come up open too often. And this one came open, and he's in the organization and he's in the department, and he gets along well with his colleagues and with his boss there. And
And
I remember talking to him about it. I asked him, I was like, cause he was talking about like trying to figure out who to recommend and did I know anybody that I might recommend? And so I asked him, I'm like, could you do it? And do you want to do it? Cause I didn't know how it might fit in with all the other million other cool things that he does in his life.
Uh-huh,
And he said, I think I'm the perfect sub for that job, but I don't think I should be the A guy. And I was like, well, okay. So just, you know, tell them you want to be the sub, because then at least
they know that.
So they did end up hiring a couple of people who are now sharing the duties, who I've gotten to know just a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And so they seem to be doing well as far as I could tell. And Max speaks highly of them. So, but yeah, hopefully someday he'll get, you know,
yeah,
he'll at least get to sub a few games or something.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure.
Super cool.
I'm sure when he got the, I'm just guessing, but he probably got the gig and then realized how tough the gig of the running the scoreboard and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But then he probably realized how tough a job you actually had. You know?
Yeah. Or just that it's not like maybe that kind of just like constantly coming up with lots of new little short ideas isn't like his wheelhouse.
Yeah.
Cause he's a very gifted musician.
Oh my God. Yes. Yes. I've had him play in my band before in Chicago. He's really good.
But yeah. I mean, you guys know this, it's really about the fit.
Yeah.
And for some weird reason that I can only theorize about why, like, the baseball stadium is my fit.
Yeah. So, yeah. That's awesome though.
Wow.
Yeah. It's great.
I got what else? Oh, another one. Seventh inning stretch.
Oh, sure. So my wife and I have been doing ever since the pandemic started, we've been doing a living room live stream that we call Seventh Inning Stretch because of the baseball tie-in, and because we wanted it to be a daily place where people could come and, you know, just stretch it out, you know, forget how shitty everything in the world is right now for 1 hour a day and come together. And we started it at the beginning of the pandemic and, didn't know what we were getting ourselves into.
Yeah, I bet.
Other than like, I mean, we did it the first day just because it was like, I guess it was about 2 weeks into the lockdown. It was what was supposed to have been the opening day for baseball. And I was really missing baseball. And I was seeing a lot of other people posting online like, oh, I miss baseball. And then a friend of mine texted me and he's like, you should do a live stream and just pretend it's opening day and play some songs. I didn't even know the first thing about how to do that. We, you know, we Googled it. My wife helped me with the technology. We figured out how to get a camera to live stream.
Yeah.
You know, we tinkered with the sound, but I mentioned to you, you know, I have this organ in the living room that's similar to the one at Fenway. So I just set it up and started playing some tunes. And I had figured like, we'll do this for 15 minutes and a couple of people show up. Maybe somebody will send a request. And if it goes well, if we enjoy it, we could maybe think about doing it again tomorrow or next week or whatever. And a ton of people showed up and a ton of people sent in requests and we had a blast doing it. And I am not someone prior to that. I had very minimal like experience sort of being the host or being on camera.
Mm-hmm.
So that part was, it took some time to get my legs under me with that, but I was enjoying it even though I wasn't great at it. And Mary loved the process of doing this fun collaborative thing together. And so we just decided let's do it again tomorrow and see how it goes. And after the second day, we started getting media inquiries, because it just was, it was a weird viral flash. And, so then we were like, okay, I guess we're doing this every day. Because we didn't have anywhere to be, you know. Yeah,
exactly.
You know, all my gigs were canceled. Baseball was out of the question. I still had my part-time library work, but I was doing it from home with flexible hours. Wow. So we just said, let's do this every afternoon at 3 and see what happens. And I think because there was no other baseball news to report on at the time, except for doom and gloom.
Yeah.
And because there was maybe no other music performance news to report on at the time, other than doom and gloom, this, we kind of became the, like, the little poster child for, like, hey, here's something that's happy that's happening.
Yeah.
If you like music or baseball, which most people like at least one or the other.
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, for the next 2 months, it was like press every day, like international press from all over, people wanting to talk to us. And, yeah. And so then that, of course, increased the profile. I think at one point we had, you know, we were getting like 20,000 viewers a day.
Oh my God. Wow. No, it was in that. You couldn't get your song in. I don't think I ever heard my songs, but you
know. Yeah, right. No, from all over the world. Yeah, that's the thing. But I'd see your name pop up periodically and you'd be like, hey, I'm watching. Yeah. Which was always very exciting to me because that was, you know, to know that my friend, because it was crazy that strangers were watching, but it was, you know, delightful that to know that my friends were tuning in from time to time.
Yeah.
And then when baseball started last July, so we did it for 4 months every day. And then it's sort of the 15 minutes of fame kind of came and went. But we were still enjoying it. And so we said, we'll keep doing it once or twice a week. And so we still at this point are doing it once or twice a week. And it's been delightful. This really cool community of people who are all friendly and they like baseball and music and they come together and they've sort of separate just from what Mary and I are doing. Like they've become friends with each other and they're making plans to you know, meet each other in other cities and go to baseball parks together. And, you know, they made t-shirts that had our picture on it, which was very,
I want one.
Unnerving.
I want one. But, did it have this version of you or the version with the ball cap with the wig?
Oh yeah, no, that's a good question. Yeah, so I wear this ball cap that has a built-in wig just for comedic effect sometimes.
While you're playing,
a lot of people, a lot of people didn't know that it was a wig for a long time.
No,
because people didn't know me, and then one day I took it off, and the hair went with it. Someone who's a talented, you know, cartoonist, like drew these caricature cartoons of me and Mary.
Nice. That's awesome.
And then they made it into a t-shirt and they distributed the t-shirts and they donated a portion of the, you know, they donated the proceeds to, hunger organizations. And that's the other thing we've been every episode we ask people, we're like, if you can afford it, if you have the means and you like the show, please, you know, support your local food bank. And people all over the world are sending us messages to say that they're making these donations. And that
that's awesome.
I love that.
That has meant a lot, you know, to be able to turn it tangibly into something positive, you know, beyond just the sort of like the camaraderie.
Yeah. Have you been interviewing people too now on that?
So at a certain point, maybe about 3 months in, I thought, like when it was really popular, I was like, wow, we're raising a lot of money for food banks. I was like, now might be the time to like cash in some chips in terms of like, I'm going to go through my Rolodex of like baseball and music celebrities who I've had the good fortune to cross paths with in my work over the years and just invite them and see who wants to pop on the show and do a quick Zoom interview where we talk about, you know, baseball, music, pandemic life, whatever's going on. And most people said, yeah, I'd love to come on. And so, so it's been great. I've had a lot of, you know, amazing people who were sort of like, you know, sports or music heroes to me when I was growing up. And now I'm not an interviewer, but I guess now I am because I've done like 60 interviews. But it's just been,
You're an interviewer.
It's been a fun thing to do. And I've noticed that like, you know, every time somebody, you know, Mike Mills comes on or, you know, Dale Murphy, my boyhood baseball hero, came on, or, you know, Clem Burke from Blondie, who I've done a bunch of work with, like these two on. And then
didn't I see Branford Marsalis on there?
Yeah, Branford Marsalis came on twice. People make these donations. Well, that was a good friend of mine was the music supervisor on Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, last year that was the final work for what's his name before he passed away? The fellow from
Black Panther.
From Black Panther.
Yeah.
I can't believe I'm blanking on his name right now.
Yeah, I know, me too.
Chadwick Boseman.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is an incredible film that had all these amazing people working on it. And Branford did the soundtrack, and he was working closely with my friend. You might know Dawn Sutter Medell. She's married to Josh Medell, who owned Other Music for a long, long time.
Yeah.
The record store in New York City. And she's worked with a lot of bands over the years. Anyway, she's delightful. And she became very close with Branford through that process. And then when the film was coming out, I was so fascinated with it, with the story of it and everything. You know, takes place in Chicago in the 20s, and it's about a, you know, a black blues band, you know, performing in a white, producer's studio, based on an August Wilson play. And I was like, Dawn, do you want to come on? Like, I know you're not, you know, famous, but I would love to just have you on to talk about your process of working on the movie. I think people would be really interested to hear about it. I know I would. And she's like, I'm not real comfortable being kind of like interviewed. She's like, but you know, Branford would probably, like, I'll do it if Branford will do it. And I was like, I don't know Branford, so I'm not really, I don't feel like I'm in a position to ask him.
Yeah.
I said, if you feel comfortable asking him, then by all means. And she's like, oh, I'm not going to ask him to do it. I'm going to tell him to do it.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. All right. There you go. And so he came. We talked for like an hour about the movie, about his career.
Yeah.
I was in heaven. And then a few weeks later, he came back. The two of them wanted to come back and do a follow-up because they had tracked down this crazy thing. They had tracked down the actor who had done the hand shots on the piano, which was something I guess that they had really lobbied for in the film, that they were talking to the director, where they're like, you need to have these hand shots. And they found this guy who turned out he was a Pittsburgh jazz musician, and he had played bass for Errol Garner in the 70s.
Oh, wow.
And he was a playwright. And so they came back and they brought him back and told the whole story about working with each other. And like, it was just totally magical. And I was pinching myself the whole time. And it was also the very first concert I ever saw by myself without my parents. I was 12 and I went to see the first Sting solo tour, and Branford was in his band at that time. And that was like and I told Branford, I was like, that was sort of, that was my awakening of like realizing like what, like who, like the idea of session players or backing players and what that means.
Yeah.
So it was very meaningful for me to, you know, to get to tell him that 36 years later or whatever.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. I felt the same way about you. I'm like, Jesus, I'm like really talking to the Fenway organ. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Yeah.
I feel the first couple of times I was talking to you, that's because I knew some of the records you had played on that were some of my favorite records. And I was like, it's this guy. I can't believe it.
Like, he looks like a hobo. I can't believe it.
Exactly. Yeah. But then, you know, and like you'd set up the pedal steel and I'd be like, I want to get up close and see what he's doing with the pedal steel, you know, like.
It's funny because we're both doing the same thing. I'm like, Jesus Christ, he's seen so many people play and got to be in so many moments of baseball and stuff like that. It's just like crazy. It's everybody's like got that, you know, I'm totally living in my old ragged ass body, you know, and I'm like, I've done all this crazy shit and stuff, but I'm like, I want to know what you did, you know, it's or how you do it.
Yeah. I think, you know, musicians who are really, you know, who are lifers have... Mm. The ones who are lifers and who really enjoy it and who don't become cynical about it are it's because they're endlessly curious.
Yeah.
You know,
I think
and they
right.
want to meet other people and they want to learn other ways of doing it. And like, what is your path? Because everyone's path is so different. And even though your path is what it is and has been and is going to be, and you're probably not going to radically alter your path, you know, at this stage of your career, but you're still interested in seeing what kinds of radical choices other people are making.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That's why actually why we're doing this. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Like, it's the point of this podcast, right?
Yeah. It's a million ways to get from A to B. It's crazy. Dude, I'm really stoked you're here.
Thank you.
Do you want to maybe talk about the White Sox organ?
Oh yeah, sure. I'd love to.
The actual instrument. I wanted to know about your room or your setup or where do you play this? What does it look like? What's the environment
and the instrument. So there's a couple different things here. So at Fenway, I play it's a Yamaha Electone AR100. It's a mid 1990s Yamaha console, and I like it. Well, I like it, but B, I'm just so used to it, and I guess certain instruments are like this. Organs are. no two models are exactly alike. Yeah. So each one is, you know, requires some comfort. I guess guitars are kind of like that.
Oh yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
You know, that you, once you get comfortable with your axe, then you're like, oh, this is my baby.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I've come to feel about that one. And I have, one in my home that is, as I mentioned, it's extremely similar. It's not exactly the same. It's kind of, I guess you might sort of call it like the junior version.
Yeah. Yeah.
A little bit smaller, but most of the same features. And it's the location of the organ at Fenway. It's had a few different locations over the years. Most recently, it's been, I think, John, you've seen that little corner, that little cubby hole that it's tucked into. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hidden and out of sight. It's in this like restaurant club of the ballpark that looks out onto the field, but most people don't see it or know it's there because it's hidden in the corner behind an I-beam. And if you're not looking for it, you're probably not going to find it. And it's like, it is a tiny little space. It has everything I need, but it is very tiny. I mean, I can't even stand up there.
No.
Because of the, because they put a platform in underneath the organ so that I could have some view of the field. I don't have a great view of the field, but I do have a video monitor that helps me see some of the angles I can't always see.
Yeah.
But absent that platform, I couldn't see anything when they moved it there. So I was like, is there any way you can put it on a platform? So they put it in, and they measured it to my sitting height. So that my head could be as high as possible while I'm sitting watching the game, so I could have the best possible view. But it means if I stand up 2 inches, I hit my head on the ceiling.
Yeah.
And it's sort of walled in, you know, on two sides because I'm in the corner, and then on the third side by the organ, and then the fourth wall is where I can escape.
It's a cockpit.
At the end of the night.
Yeah, it's like a
It is. And I've got, you know, and I've got my video monitor. I've got an audio monitor so I can hear the public address announcer. I've got a headset so that I can communicate with the DJ and with the camera and scoreboard operators. I've got my laptop so I can take the Twitter requests. I've got an earbud so that I can stream the songs I need to learn.
Yeah.
Cyborg.
It's kind of like, it's like you're playing a live show, but you're also like producing a live production at the same time. If you're thinking about a rock concert, it's like being one of the onstage performers and one of the stage hands on a headset backstage at the same time. So that took some getting used to, but now I enjoy it. I enjoy the freneticness of it and the camaraderie of the people I get to talk to. And I have fans that come by and visit, you know, that I'll chat with sometimes. And that's always delightful because people come from all over the world. And if they've found me, it usually means that they're among the people who are particularly interested in what I'm doing, you know, which is a smaller number. I think for most people, the organ is like, it's a nice background thing, but then there's the 1% that's like, wow, the organ, that's amazing. Tell me more about it.
Yeah.
So those are always cool conversations. And, so that's kind of what the setup is like, you know. And then John was asking about the White Sox organ. My hero and mentor in this field is this woman, Nancy Faust, who was the organist for the Chicago White Sox from 1970 through 2010. So she did it for 41 years.
Damn.
She started very young. I think she was 23 when she started, and she is widely regarded as sort of the Picasso of what we do. She was very innovative, very ahead of her time, very clever. She was the first person she was 23 in 1970. And when she came in, all the other organists were older and they were all playing. None of them had gotten around to, none of them were interested in rock and roll. None of them thought that Elvis or Chuck Berry was worth anything, you know? So they were playing their old very Tin Pan Alley songs, and they were playing their old show tunes, and they were playing their old crooner numbers, you know, stuff that was popular pre-1954.
Yeah.
And there's no shortage of great material from there, but baseball was changing and the demographics of the baseball crowd were changing. And she came in and she was like, I'm going to play, you know, it was 1970s. She's like, I'm going to play the pop and rock and R&B hits of the 1960s. And no one had done that before. And people went crazy for it. Young people and old people, because there was so much rich material there and so much great high energy material there. And so that was a big part of it. But she also, throughout her 41 years, she always continued to update. So even in 2010, she was learning the popular songs of the day at that time. She never rested on a repertoire. She was like, she was always learning more new stuff, always updating, which was, again, was something the other, you know, the old dinosaurs hadn't really done. They hadn't adapted that way. And she was very accessible to people. You know, she, people, her booth was, you could find her very easily in the concourse and people would come by and interact with her and she'd get friends with people and they would request songs. So she was, I sort of got the song request idea from her, except I did it in this digital realm, you know, on Twitter, but she would just take them in person from people who would walk by. And she, you know, she was the first person to really do a lot of sort of clever wordplay where she would play a song based on something that was happening on the field. I'm trying to think of an example, like, you know, in the 70s when streakers were very popular, you know, people would just like streak across the field naked. And so like every time there was a streaker, she would play like, I got plenty of nothing or, you know,
that's awesome.
Or she would play, is that all there is?
Yeah.
You know, just to make these sort of, these cheeky comments on things that were happening
cheeky?
In the game.
Yeah. Cheeky.
Exactly. Or things that were happening in the stands or things that were commenting on like the play that had just happened.
Yeah.
And she also was the first person. I mean, now it's totally ubiquitous. If you go to a ball game, you'll hear for the home team, each player has sort of like their own theme song that they've personally selected that they want to hear when they come up. She was the first person ever to do that before there were DJs at the games. And she would just pick songs for the players based on whatever she knew about them, about their personality or about where they came from or about their number. You know, so if somebody's wearing, you know, number 3 and she would play 3 Dog Night or, you know, what, just these different kinds of things. Or she would do this word play, you know, so if somebody, I'm trying to think of an example. I don't know, but like, so there was this player on the White Sox named Steve Lyons, but his nickname was Psycho. And so she would play Psycho Killer when he came up, you know, or then, you know, but it's also cool. That last name was Lyons. So then sometimes she would play The Lion Sleeps Tonight, but she was just always doing these kinds of things, way ahead of her time. And now everybody does it everywhere. So long way of saying she's the best. I adore her. And it turns out she's, you know, twice as nice as she is talented. So I went to high school in Chicago and I would go to those games and I would kind of watch her. And I remember even as a teenager thinking like, that must be the coolest job in the world, not knowing what would happen. But I was always interested in music because I was interested in keyboard. I was interested in, you know, obviously this kind of like clever improvisation stuff and had done that. So, but so when I got the gig in 03, I called her immediately and I was like, I don't know if you remember me. I was one of those annoying teenagers that used to just sit and watch you. And she's like, no, I don't. And I said, well, I said, I got the gig and I might be a little in over my head. Like I've never played for more than, like most of my gigs are 50 to 100 people. And I've never played for more than 600 people in my whole life. And she was like, you know, next time you come to visit your parents in Chicago, because my parents have lived in Chicago since the mid 80s. She said, come by the house. She said, I have 2 organs in the living room. We'll play some duets. I'll give you some tips. Some pointers. And so that day I immediately booked a trip.
Went out to see her. I'll be there in a minute.
Absolutely. And we did, you know, it was like a day long masterclass where she taught me all kinds of tips and tricks, encouraged me to keep updating the repertoire, taught me how to, you know, how to voice chords and melodies in a way that, you know, how to accentuate the melody to make sure, cause that's the part people are going to hum along with or sing along with or recognize, you know, how to not get too fancy with it, you know, how to keep it simple, how to generate fun ideas. It just was like, it was the coolest day ever. And then I stayed in touch with her after that. And then we became friends and in her retirement the last 10 years or so, like we, you know, we visit each other, you know, from time to time and we stay in touch. And I've always tried to like shine a spotlight on her work because I feel like she's a little under heralded. So it's been nice, you know, when I do get, you know, when I do interviews with major outlets and I'll be like, you guys need to do it. You know, it's fine that you want to do a story about me, but you really need to do a story about Nancy Faust. Right. Cause she's where it's at. And, then I think 5 or 6 years ago, she decided to put the organ she had used for all those decades. She put it up for auction, for a charity auction. And I was so excited about it. And I assumed, I was like, well, there's no way I'm going to be able to afford it. The bidding is going to skyrocket way out of my price range, you know, quickly, I'm sure. But I was thinking like, maybe I can convince like one of my rock star friends to buy it so that at least then I can go visit it from time to time. So I emailed everybody I knew to be like, hey, one of you should buy this thing.
Oh man.
And then, and I had no plans to bid. And then the auction, it came up and the bidding was a little sluggish at the beginning. I think it was like a 24-hour thing. And I said to my wife, I was like, I'm real tempted to bid. Could you maybe just like talk me out of it, please? And she said, I can talk you out of it if you want, but honestly, I would much rather talk you into it because I can think of a million reasons why this would be amazing. So she talked me into it. So I made a bid and then it got outbid and I made another bid. And I was like, I think this is probably about as high as I can go at this time. There was some dumb luck involved, I guess. And I ended up being the winning bidder. And I remember I saw you play in Connecticut that night, John, the night that I had won the bid. So we were very excited to talk about it.
Uh-huh.
And then the only catch was it had to be picked up at the White Sox ballpark. And then somehow delivered to me. And there was a deadline for when to pick it up.
Yeah.
So many musicians I knew were so excited about it. People were like so eager to help. They're like, do you want me to get a moving van? Do you want me to like help you pick it up? Do you want me to store it at my place in Chicago until you have a chance to come get it? Whatever. And then finally what emerged, like literally all in the same day, Kelly Hogan and Gerald Dowd, who I'm sure you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Chicago drummer. And Dave Max Crawford, the aforementioned horn player. The three of them, each separately from each other, messaged me and said, you know, can I drive this to you like next time I'm playing in Boston? And so I put the three of them in touch with each other. I figured they probably knew each other. I didn't realize until after I, you know, quote unquote, introduced them that they all knew each other very well and had traveled together and could travel well together. And so I was like, well, it's in your hands. They hatched a plan. They took full control of it. They rented a minivan. They went and picked it up. And we scheduled it. So I was like, I'll get you guys a gig out here if you want to come do a gig. And it ended up, the timing just couldn't have been more perfect. There was there's an annual charity rock show that's put on here by Peter Gammons, the famed baseball writer, who's also a huge rock fan. And it usually involves a lot of people who are affiliated with the Red Sox and Theo Epstein, who had been the general manager here and was the guy who broke the curse and got the Red Sox to win their first World Series in a million years. Yeah. And then after he did that, he went to Chicago and he broke the curse for the Cubs and he got them to win. Yeah. So it was an annual event in Boston and then in the winter. And then he made it in the summer, also an annual event in Chicago where a lot of Chicago, you know, Cubs people and Chicago rock people would play. And so there was all this overlap between Chicago and Boston indie rock people, Chicago and Boston baseball people. And I was like, you guys should just come play this show. You know, like I'm part of the group that's putting together the personnel for it. And I just think you should come do it. And so they came, they brought the organ, they chronicled their adventures.
Yeah.
You know, they would do little video blogs. People like the press started calling them while they were on the road. and they just made it into, they're like, we're going to make this into a thing, you know? Yeah. And they had, they made a short film that was really beautiful. And then they got it here and we brought it in the living room and a bunch of the musicians who were playing the charity gig, like came over that morning, and just hung out and we kind of celebrated and toasted the organ and I played a couple tunes on it and everyone started singing in harmony. And, it was just like totally magical moment. And now I have this organ in my living room and I look at it every day and I play it sometimes and it brings me all these great memories. And that was actually the first time I had met Gerald and Max in person. And ever since then I've played with them a bunch in Boston and Chicago and elsewhere. And, you know, I just made so many, made so many happy connections and reconnections from that whole adventure.
Yeah. Yeah. See, yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. That's, how it fucking works. You just got to be nice and have fun and do strange, odd things, man.
Yeah. Be nice all the time.
Yeah.
Be open to adventure, be curious. And good things will happen.
Yeah.
I like the curious thing. Curious.
That's a lot of, that's one I miss saying. I do it. And I think it's a big part of it, but I never, that one doesn't stick out there that much, but it is. It's a great thing. Awesome, man.
I love this.
Should we wrap it?
Yeah.
Josh, I can't believe I'm so glad you came. and calling in too. Today.
As soon as you told me you were gonna, you know, start up this show, I was like, well, I gotta get in there, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you got the call because, you know, this is exactly the kind of stuff. It's awesome, man. So just doing the home games right now and
doing home games, and you know, I'm doing the weekly live stream, and cool. If anybody wants to watch
that? When is that?
It's Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern on Facebook. It's called Seventh Inning Stretch. And I haven't booked any shows yet. I'm still kind of waiting to see. I often get added to the gigs after they're booked.
Yeah.
So I'm waiting to see how things play out. I'm waiting to gauge my own comfort level with playing out with traveling. Yeah. I have a couple of things tentatively booked for October for the Mid-Atlantic.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to put together some plans to tour like 9 months from now. Uh-huh. But nothing imminent, you know, if the right thing comes up a week from now or a month from now, I'll do it. But I haven't graduated to that point yet.
That's kind of like what's going on. I mean, we're out here in Arizona where it's the, you know, all bets are off thing. They don't, you know, they're like, no, we don't have masks out here.
Yeah, right.
And we've been doing just a few, and I got some stuff coming up with Nico, but that's right. That starts end of August or mid August, end of August.
And I'm going to be at that Woodstock show. So
I'm not going to be at that one. That's the only one. I know. It's the only one I'm not on. Come yeah. On,
all right.
It's just because
I have 3 weeks to learn how to play pedal steel. Then,
there you go. Yeah, exactly. Get on it.
It's not that hard, right?
No. Yeah. No, that would have been me flying me to New York, flying me.
Yeah,
back
right.
home and then flying me out to Albuquerque and like yeah. you know, it was
too
just
much
like,
flying.
Yeah. It was just crazy. But right. I'm on the rest of it. So cool. Awesome, babe. Well, thank you very much, Josh.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, guys. Yes, thank really you, appreciate it.
Really, really, really appreciate it. And you have a great time out there, man.
Thank you, sir.
It's been hot here, so I don't know how it is there, but
it's not been that hot. We're having like a pretty reasonable, you know. Like nice to be outside kind of summer. So
awesome.
Far, so nice. I'll take it.
All right, babe.
I love it.
We're going to hit the outro theme song and you take care, babe. We love you.
All right. Thanks.
I got a gig. It's an easy load.
This one, you made me a rock star to my son today when I was heading. He goes, who are you talking to? And I told him, he's like, what? What? It was a big deal. Yeah.
Well, you guys, you know, come visit sometime. I'll show you backstage.
Heck yeah, there you go. Awesome.
Thank you, man.
Yeah.
Take care.
All right, babe. So
bye. Take care. I got a game. Love nice. It.
No, I don't do it.
Yeah.
I got a game. I don't do it for the money. I got a game.
Recording in progress.
Yes, I do.
This is like a music video. I like this.
Yeah, exactly. Come on, Darren.
Traveling with Josh.
Come on, Darren.
Today we take a tour.
Yeah, exactly. Darren's trying to figure out how to shut the thing off.
Okay.
Recording stopped.
Well, that was good.
That was fucking awesome.
Dude, he hit all the points.
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
I know.
It was beautiful.
Yeah. Oh. That's all right, man.
That's all right.
It's a podcast.
Don't do it, Darren. Don't you hurt yourself.
Stop the cutting.
Don't, Darren. You have value and we love you.
You're an idiot.
But we got the audio.
Yeah.
You're like,
if you don't have the audio, then we will kill you.
We'll hold you down and tickle you. We're into that now. That was great.
All right. You guys going to keep on talking?
Oh, shit. No. Yeah. I don't know.